I'm going to pick up again at verse 6. I think we had gotten down to that point. I want to pick up the concept I gave you last week about what they call here in the Greek text the teleios, from the Greek word which means the end or consummation of something. In the King James Version, and I don't know what other versions, this verse is translated, "But we speak wisdom among the perfect." Two words that have to be lifted out here are the words for wisdom and perfect. Perfectionism, as I've often said to you, is a disease. It's a great burden on the part of people who, usually from a genetic background, have become perfectionists, where everything has to be done just so, or they're not satisfied. Problem with that, of course, is that life isn't all that perfect. Things are not that readily handled to the optimum degree. There are a lot of people who, in the Christian faith, strive for perfection because of that word cropping up in the Bible, whereas the word perfect, as we know it, does not really occur in the Greek Testament. The only thing you could apply perfection to is God, really, because nothing else is that perfect, and the Bible is not a book of illusions. Other books might use the word, but the Bible knows, is an analysis of life. It's not a fairy tale. The two major words that are translated perfect are katartizo, which means to mend or repair something, correct something, and teleo, which means to fulfill or consummate something. So we are perfected in Christ in terms of the fact of being brought back to wholeness, mended. We're all a bunch of mended pots or vases. If you haven't fallen off the shelf yet and had to be mended, you may be living in a fantasy world. But so mending is one of the major words translated by perfect. It occurs dozens of times in the New Testament, the word and its derivatives. For you gentlemen who are mastering the Greek language, the word is katartizo, but it occurs in many different kinds of forms. Kata is a prefix, and the word is really from the classics, for the guys that are in the Greek course. Artio, A-R-T-I-O, or Alpha Rho Tau Iota Omega, if you are not familiar with the English alphabet, English transliteration. Artio. It all has the idea of being mended, straightened out, put back together again. The other word, teleo, has to do, as I say, with fulfillments. It is a totally abominable translation here in verse 6 of 1 Corinthians 2. I can't think of a worse word to put in here than this one, because it misses the point of what it means to be a Christian. To be a Christian does not mean to be perfect, any more than to be adopted into a family means to be perfect. But it does mean to be consummated. That is, to be brought into that context which God has ordained for mankind. So you are among the teleoi if you have joined God's family and are therefore in the stream of consummation of God's purposes in the universe. So we are all a part of God's purposes in the universe. The word wisdom, let me remind you, and just briefly again, means here not discretion, not pragmatism, that is, practicality. Mostly we think of the word wisdom as meaning not intelligence, but the discretionary use of intelligence, that is to use our minds properly, realistically. When Paul says we speak wisdom among the perfect, he's not saying we're teaching you people who are perfect how to be more perfect by being wise. No, wisdom here means that body of understanding which has to do with the central meaning of the universe. That's what the Greeks called wisdom. That's what the sophists were interested in. And the word sophia is the word wisdom. Some of you may have heard in terms of the Greek classics or history of a group called the sophists. I've certainly made you aware of them in the last 3 weeks. A sophist is one who debates the issues of the meaning of the universe. So when Paul speaks of his wisdom, he says, we do not speak to you human wisdom. He is not bringing an alternative philosophy to them, you see. He's giving them God's view of the world rather than man's view of the world. If any of you are conversant with philosophy, you run into a term called a Weltanschauung. It's a tongue twister. It's spelled Weltanschauung. Weltanschauung. It means in German, world view. The philosophers like to use obscure terminology because when they talk to you, they can feel very, very superior because they know that they are using terms that you don't know anything about. And if you do not use their terms, you are not a philosopher, you are a hack. You may be saying the same thing. A worldview, in simple terms, is what we all have. You don't have to be a philosopher to have a worldview. If you think that the whole meaning of the world is life and death, that's a worldview. If you think the world is made out of lollipops and licorice, that's your worldview. Maybe a screwy one, but it's your worldview. If you think the whole reason people were born on the earth was to enjoy themselves, that's very naive, but it's your worldview. Paul is saying we are not giving you a humanistic worldview, but we are speaking to you people who belong to the stream of God's purpose in the universe. You are the teleoi, the consummated. We're speaking to you. And we're giving you the things that God says about the universe, and we are not giving you the things that Aristotle says or Plato or Socrates, because they were sort of the triumvirate, the three kings of the comic opera called philosophy. So anyway, people in Corinth especially would have been conversant with this term. But you notice he does not use that term regularly in other books. But he is using it here in a way that the Corinthian people would know because the Corinthian people were sophisticated people and would be, the difference would be between from them and the average Greek villager, someone who dwelt, for example, on the Isle of Kos or Rhodes or Patmos, would have been in comparison to Corinth, the Corinthian, would have been a resident of some rural community in the Middle West versus someone who's a resident of a major city like Los Angeles or New York or something like that. Corinth was to the Greeks what Los Angeles or New York would be to the Americans today. Every hamlet and village in America has, more or less, I mean, generally speaking, been touched with literacy. Even the hillbilly land where I was born. Some of you may not be aware of the fact that I'm a hillbilly. You didn't know that. I'm just an old archy. I was born in Arkansas in a little town of 3,000 people called Siloam Springs. Even in the little towns like that, everybody went to school, generally. You know, we had school, we had education, and literacy is a very significant point in America. But in Greece, the villages like Mykonos or Rhodes or Kos or any of those villages would not have been literate. They wouldn't know how to read very much. Probably the letters Paul sent to the churches had to pretty well be read by the leading brother of the congregation. Xerox had not even been there yet. You'd have had a tough time finding a place to duplicate Paul's letters. You'd have had to shinny up to the top of these monastery hills and peaks in Greece and get them to copy it for you. No, they didn't copy Paul's letter. Probably the whoever was the lector or the lecturer, the reader for a given congregation would read it. If he could read it, if anybody could read it. Whereas Paul can speak to the Greeks of Corinth about this matter of universal knowledge, he could not have spoken of those things to the average villager of a Greek community, because they would not be conversant with that kind of thing. Now, Paul is then addressing these people and saying, I can say to you who are in the stream of God's purposes, I can say to you that this is what the nature of life and the universe is. Now, if you hold that in your mind, if you take that as a key to what Paul says in the subsequent verses, it'll help you a lot. He's talking about the issues of what the universe is all about. He says, we speak of wisdom to those that are consummated, but a wisdom not of this age, nor of the rulers of this age, which are coming to naught, but we speak the wisdom of God in a mystery, which was hidden, which God foreordained before the age unto our glory. God foreordained before the ages. The word ages is a designation for simply the sequence of history, of the history of mankind. In the time spectrum, we occupy a space-time spectrum or space-time cosmos. And that does not have to be expanded. You all understand that. If you ever ran into somebody's fender, you know that you can't have two automobiles on the same space at the same time. Some of you may not have discovered that yet, but it doesn't work. You drive your car 3 feet into your neighbor's trunk, it probably will do some damage. This is just a fact of life, see, but this is the, when you talk about revealing that God foreordained this before the ages, he's saying this was all established before you had the evolving of a space-time sequence of life. It was in the eternity past. Now, he says, we do not speak the things of this age, but the things of, of human wisdom, but the things of God, which were foreordained before the ages unto our glory. Now I'm going to lift out several things here. Going back to the word mystery, he says, we speak the wisdom of God in a mystery. He is not saying to you, we're talking to you in riddles. He's not saying to you, I'm presenting the unknowable. Socrates, Plato, Aristotle played games with the unknowable. To the human mind, the things they were talking about were not at all available. They could only speculate. Plato could talk about the logos and about time and about all these things, but he was only speculating, as he himself made abundantly clear. Nobody really cares what he said now. He doesn't even care. He knows better. He has finally come to see the folly of his own writings. Anyway, Paul is not speaking in riddles. He's not speaking in obscure philosophical terms. But he is speaking in terms that are available only to the initiated. Available only to the members of the body of Christ. And that's what the Greek word mysterion means. Not something unknowable, but something that is only knowable by those who are a part of that complex. You see, we would call them the initiated. Just like the terminology of a certain club might be only known by those who have been initiated into that club. You see. So mystery here means that which is known only by the people that are candidates to know it, the initiated. And that's what these teleoi are. They are initiated into this fraternity of understanding by the Spirit of Christ, which we shall discover later. But now a marvelous phrase here is that God ordained this unto our glory. Now, what that means is we shall have done with this wretched sandbox in time, and whatever our follies are now, the day is coming when we shall be glorified. Have any of you ever had the experience of observing a child at play in the mud hole in the backyard or in the sandbox, especially when the child is wet for numbers of reasons? And he's playing in the sandbox, and he's also at the same time had access to the hose, making various and sundry goodies. You take a look at the child and you want to get the hose and squirt on it. There are times when you see these children, all you can do is just take the hose to them. I guess we did that to our youth because they're a mess. Now, I'm here to tell you that as much as I think you're all delightful people, I'm afraid there's an awful lot of sand sticking on you here and there, myself included, I have to say. We're sandbox savants. We're people of the sandbox. To the day you die, and the idiocies you mouth will someday be looked upon as kindergarten corn. Right now, we're caught in that space-time universe with all of our follies, but thank God the day is coming when this will be over, and we will have done with human folly, and now we'll be with God in the full meaning of who we are. Now we're in the process of God's purposes. Then we shall have come to the ultimate fulfillment of God's purpose for it. And we'll have done with this cracked pot that we live in, this ceramic cocoon called our body, this clay thing, and with all of its miseries and wretchedness, its total absurdity will be over. You have to stand back and laugh at yourself in a mirror. Because whether you believe it or not, you're absurd. But I'm that way too, see, we're all in the same boat. Just look at yourself and laugh, and you may make it through this world, this veil of tears, because it's funny. You know, the most comic routines on the stage or the screen or wherever, the most comic routines are always the very simple statement of actualities. All you have to do is describe the scene at the average dinner table. You have everybody rolling in the aisles, and all you're doing is just describing what took place that morning at the table or that evening. It's just a joke. Somebody said something about, I was reading a newspaper when they came up, and they said, well, I only read the comics, you know. And I said, it's a lot funnier reading the front page of the Wall Street Journal. So I get a lot more laughs out of that. We should be through with this comic opera called our lives, but if we can look at it now and laugh at ourselves and look at the absurdity of things, and we therefore will avoid getting perhaps so uptight about some things, they're not going to make a whole lot of difference in the end anyway. What I want to really believe with you is that we are nevertheless slated for glory, and the frog shall become a prince. Today it's the other way around. The little prince is born, everybody's delighted with it, it's so cherubic and lovely, and it isn't long before it becomes a toad, you know. But this is the absurdity of life. But we're going to be glorified. The frog will become a prince. And the bumblebee a princess. You can draw your own conclusions about those things. All right. Paul is saying all of this is unto our glory. God has an end in view for this world and for these persons that we are. An end in view that will be really glorious. And you can look for that, and you can take that to the bank, as some of our comic actors say. It's a wonderful thing to be able to do that. To know that this awkward adolescent is nevertheless one day going to be a reasonably useful adult. That's what Paul means when he says in 1 Corinthians 13, When I was a child, I spake as a child, I thought as a child, I understood as a child. When I became a man, I put away childish things. He was not saying that as a Christian, I started out immature and now I'm getting more and more mature. He was not saying that at all. But the very next verse says, now we see through a glass darkly, then face to face. Now we know in part, then shall we know even as we are known. And by that he means that though now I'm a child, then when I'm glorified, I'll be an adult. And he's not comparing one Christian with another in terms of maturity. You will never hear that verse talked of in that way. Usually it has to do with Christian maturity if you ever read about it somewhere or read a commentary. None of us will be really mature till we reach the other side. Now, this truth, he says, not one of the rulers of this age knew, for if they had known, they would not have crucified the Lord of glory. What does he mean by that? The rulers of this age, the archonton, are really, from other places in Scripture, more likely to be applied to Satan's agents. He's not really using the word to apply to as much to human rulers as to these agents of Satan who might perhaps take human form. Do you think that Satan would have allowed Jesus to be crucified by his agents had he known that the very crucifying of Satan was his own undoing? When his agents, who thought they were destroying the Son of God, crucified Christ, in reality, they were marking the death of Satan, the destruction of Satan. Because Christ overcame death and overcame Satan in his crucifixion and his subsequent resurrection. So that's what it means. Had these people known, or had these agents of Satan known what the ultimate end of Christ's crucifixions were, they would not have allowed him to be crucified. And so then he says, but even as it is written, eye has not seen and ear has not heard, and it has not entered upon the heart of man the things which God has prepared for those who love him. Now, normally you will hear that verse quoted in terms of our heavenly hope. And people will often say, well, eye has not seen or ear heard what God has prepared for them that love him. And they think in terms of mansions and heavenly glories and so forth. If they really believed that, I mean, if they were going to be consistent, they would then quit mouthing these sentimental idiocies about heaven, which they talk about, which are really duplications of things on earth that have been our undoing. The very mansions that they project have been become the focal point of human greed on earth, and probably would be in heaven if God were really going to put mansions up there. Nevertheless, we know it does not refer to that, because the very next verse says, but God has revealed it to us through his Spirit. For the Spirit searches all things, even the deep things of God. For who has known the things of men except the Spirit of man which is in him? What it really says, who among men or who of men has known the things of man except the Spirit of man which is in him? So also the things of God no one has known except the Spirit of God. Now, he is obviously then not talking about the material goodies of heaven, a glorified Disneyland. He's talking about spiritual values, the deep things of God. What are the deep things of God? The deep things of God are not to be seen as the inner sanctum of spiritual knowledge as far as truths are concerned, per se. You hear people talking about the deeper Christian life. I always shudder when I hear that word because I know that someone is thinking, I'm just a little bit deeper than that person. Some of us are very deep and some of us are very shallow. And guess who you belong to of that group, you see. I mean, the speaker belongs always to those. But the deep things of God have to do with the dimension of God's divinity. Ephesians gives us the four dimensions of God's person and of life with Christ. In his discussion of the matter of love, he says in the verse 18, I guess we can start with, that you may be utterly able to apprehend with all saints what is the breadth and length and height and depths. Well, you got four dimensions there. Here we are talking about the breadth of God's love. I should go on to read verse 19. And to know the love of Christ which surpasses knowledge, that you may be filled with all the fullness of God. We partake of God's depth, of the total dimension of God in our spirit. We know the unknowable because we have taken Christ into our spirits, and he is within us what God is. That's why we're filled with the fullness of God when we have Christ in us. Whatever it is that God is, we have in us. We can't articulate it. We don't know what we know. Our spirit knows what our mind cannot articulate. Can't even comprehend it. Now you have with God the length and breadth and height and depths. Those are all separate dimensions. Now for us, height and depth would be one dimension. But the word depth here plumbs the ultimate realities of God. We use the word depth in terms of layers of meaning. That's why we say, well, that writing has depth to it. We mean it has layers and layers of meaning. There are layers and layers to the understanding of God that go beyond the capacity of the human being to discern. These are the layers of meaning in God. Height has to do with the ultimate reaches of divine glory, the supra-heavenly, the epiuranios, for you fellows that study Greek. The height represents the epiuranios, that is, that which is the supra-heavenly, above the heavens, going beyond the heavens into spiritual realms. Don't want to get too far off on that. All I want to say is that there are dimensions to God, multi-dimensions probably, not just four. There are dimensions to God which have to do with the meaning of his depth, the layers of meaning to God. And he says the Spirit searches out these levels of God, of the meaning of God. For who among men knows the things of man except the spirit of man which is in him? And so also the things of God no one knows except the Spirit of God. But we receive not the spirit of the world, but the Spirit which is of God, that we may know the things which are freely given to us by God. Okay, now this may seem a little technical, but the basic thing I want to get at is that there is a depth to God's meaning that we have in our spirits that our spirits participate in, but our minds do not always comprehend. You have depth to you, your mind does not understand. Because having taken the Spirit of Christ within, you are now qualified and conditioned for eternal reality. So even now you are eternal. Even now, possessing the Spirit of Christ, you occupy the dimensions of the universe that the human mind can't even express. Right now, you're that way. As a spirit being, never mind the cloak, never mind the ceramic outer covering, the clay pot, cracked though it be, never mind that. You are a spirit being who even now has participated to a degree in the glory of God. And we only wait for this outer shell to be broken away for the full expression of all we're intended to be. Now, that's the clear teaching of Paul in 1 Corinthians or 2 Corinthians 4, 6 and 7, we can quote here tonight, where he says, God, who commanded the light to shine out of darkness, has shined in our hearts to give the light of the knowledge of the glory of God in the face of Jesus Christ, or in the presence of Christ. But we have this treasure in earthen vessels, that the excellency of the power may be of God and not of us. The glory of God is in you tonight. That's what he says here. This is unto our glory. Glory of God is in you. But the fleshly cocoon keeps us from fully expressing that glory. Question.
It's a grand thing, but what practical use is it?
Very important practical use. That is that you are now a marvelous creature, and you should bank on that part of you more than on the external as being the reality of you. That doesn't mean you don't pay attention to the externals, but you live in the reality of what you have inside. I think it's a simple issue of how you relate to human persons, whether you put all your store in the outer appearance and not the adorning of the heart. And this was what Peter was getting at when he said to the women, don't spend all your time adorning the outer vessel and ignore the heart. He didn't say women shouldn't wear adornments. That's a foolish application of that text. Peter was not concerned about whether somebody wore a ringlet or a bracelet or whatever. He's saying, don't bank on that. Bank rather on the inner hearts. I'm saying to you by the same token, don't judge yourself in terms of the outer covering. Don't judge the ultimate meaning of life in terms of the outer covering. You relate to people around you and you say, boy, that's an odious person. You say, well, don't worry about that point in time. They're going to be very glorious persons. Of course, you're not odious yourself. It's just the people around you that you're concerned about. It's a great thing when you get frustrated with yourself, when you get frustrated with human folly. Now, some of you may not ever be there. Many of you just function very adroitly and cleverly and so forth with life. But some of us occasionally get involved in folly. We say, what's it all worth, you know? We say, well, I'll tell you what it's worth. It's that inside thing. I said, what's in you? Which is as much more important than your body or your external person as the jewel is to the jewel case. Both are needed, the case and the jewel. Temporarily, the case is needed here. But the reality is the jewel within, and that's what we should cultivate. And that's what we should focus our attention on. These are the things freely given us by God, not stingily given, but freely given, as the Greek word is, the things that pertain to our inner spirit. Then he goes on to say, which things also we speak, not in the didactic words of human wisdom, not in the teaching words, in the pedagogical or didactic words of human wisdom, but in the teachings of the Spirit. It isn't the Platonic concepts of the universe, but the wisdom of the Spirit, what the Spirit understands by the universe. Spiritual persons coming to grips with spiritual things. Up above he says we are speaking to the teleios. Now if you're watching your Greek Testament, some of you gentlemen, your first, in verse 6, it says, we speak wisdom to the teleios, to the consummated. Now he says, the pneumatikos, the spiritual ones, which is a parallel to the consummated ones. You see, you've got to go over all that, because he says, we are speaking to spiritual persons. That's why that's in a dative. That's why I'm talking about the parallel there. You got to skip over 100 words or so to get to the compound indirect object. We are speaking to the consummated. We are speaking to the spiritual ones. Now, he's not talking about spiritual here in terms of being goody-goody two-shoes. He's talking about spiritual being people who are spirit in nature, who grasp a spirit universe, and therefore can flow with him in these thoughts. In verse 14, but the natural, the psychical man, and psychikos doesn't just mean the physical person, it's the psychical, the mental person, a person, we are psychical beings because we have this mental process going on in us. We're not just animals. The psychical man, the natural man, does not receive the things of the Spirit of God, for they are foolishness to him, and he is not able to know them because they are spiritually discerned. Only the people who are spirit people can discern these spirit things. But they are, in a certain sense, according to other places of Paul, things that remain within the spirit, but our minds do not always grasp and function in the understanding of these things. But we do have that great body of spiritual reality within us. Well, I think we've stopped there.